Good morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to the viewing audience across the pond. I am Jason Miles, your host, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Thank you guys so much for your patience. As you can see, I'm not in the usual studio. If you don't see me in the usual studio, then you best believe the mother of all issues has been happening once again to me. I left to go see my son for his birthday, and I got back home and nothing has worked right since from a show standpoint. But we are still here. We're still going to do the show. Before I bring in our guest, I do want to do a quick content warning for the show topic today. A bit of a heavy subject matter, so heavy that nobody wanted to do the show with me. So there's that. We'll be talking about suicide and drug addiction. If those subjects are too heavy for you and you're more used to the lighter content of this show, especially on Saturday, because this is the Saturday free show, we had some other great shows this week that you should definitely check out. Pascal Robert had a hell of a Mau Mau Hour with Milton Alamadi, so definitely go check that out. They may be a little lighter in tone for you. That being said, I'd like to send a big thank you to all the subscribers on all the platforms. YouTube, Twitch, all the audio-only platforms. Without you, we couldn't do this. If you enjoy what we do here and find some value in this type of programming and you'd like to support and you'd like to have access to Champagne Rooms past and present, be a part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert-hosted Mau Mau Hour, there's only one way. Become a patron for as little as $3 a month, $30 for the year. It can all be yours. If you don't want to be bound by the tyranny of a monthly subscription service, you just want to show your thanks, drop a super chat or a super thanks, a like, and a share. Those simple gestures go a very, very long way. I feel so bad that you guys have to see my room. I just finished recording, well, last week, the final song in the Black Yacht Rock trilogy. So as you can see, I haven't cleaned up. So don't judge me. It's judgment free. But before we bring in our guest, I was reading his book, and I suggest you guys check it out. Blown Away, Dealing with the Suicide of Your Child. If you've watched TIR for some time, you know that I'm a parent of a few children. If you've been watching the show this week, you probably also noticed that I haven't been in the studio as I went up to the Bay Area to see my kids, as the youngest had a birthday this week. Getting to see his face light up when our eyes met, playing with him and his cousins until it was time for bed, building racing tracks and cleaning up messes was well worth the grueling drive. I don't think I'm any different than most fathers, especially older ones like me, that are getting a second chance at child rearing, this time more mature and with a clear head. A certain patience I didn't have as a young parent. All these moments I get to spend with my kids are cherished, never taken for granted. Not because I fear the worst for them, but because the distance between us makes it hard. My situation is only temporary. Death is permanent. And when I saw another friend of ours, Kike Autry, touting the book of our guest, I felt it was something that I wanted to cover on TIR. Loss, sadness, depression, addiction, tragedy are things many of us are hit with, and it can cause us to spiral regardless of how strong and prepared to handle it we think we are. Our guest today wrote a memoir of his dealing with his son's suicide and his therapy that led him to discover so much about himself and his relationship with his one and only son. From the book Blown Away, this book is about a father's attempt to staunch the greatest possible wound with some measure of understanding. Putting down the phone that night, my world no longer made sense to me. I had lost the primary thing, the one thing I would unsatiably have given my life for. In fact, I felt like I was already dead, just still walking around. It was that desperate need for understanding that drove me into the terrible silence of an analyst's consulting room. It was the beginning of a long period of nausea in which the only thing greater than the pain of talking was the torment of saying nothing. It would be a long period of relentless questioning, very much including obsessively questioning my own questions. My son's death plunged me into a long and anguished period of self-interrogation. But then, after some years of being crippled by grief, something surprising happened. I seemed again to find myself and refined life, almost against my will. Thus, unexpectedly, but deeply revitalizing result was in large part a hard-won fruit of my time in analysis. That is an excerpt from the book Blown Away by our guest, professor and author, Dr. Richard Boothby. Yay! Usually, I have an applause track that usually goes when I do this. So I'm having it. So it makes me kind of sad. Thank you so much for hanging out with me, and thank you so much for your patience as I was dealing with some insane audio issues.
Not a problem.
How are you this fine afternoon?
I'm great, thank you. It's not too hot here in Baltimore. It's a lovely blue day, and so that's got me pretty happy, actually.
Well, I'm jealous because the first day I'm back, the clouds came in, and there's even a little bit of a tropical drizzle. So, It's Mexico. What are you going to do? But thank you for sharing your journey in attempting to deal with the tragedy no parent, wife, significant other, child, friend is ready to deal with. First off, I need to know, what prompted you to want to write this book so many years after the tragic incident?
Well, that goes, to the heart of the whole thing. It wasn't a choice almost. First of all, you need to know that my son Oliver died now 17 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I almost immediately started writing little tidbits, in any form I could get them, because it was just a survival technique. It was trying to even make sure that my own voice was still there. It was really desperate. And I initially couldn't write well about it. Only about 2 years in, I started really sitting down, and I took a summer, and I'm a college professor, so I had a summer, and I just sat on the front porch and smoked cigarettes and wrote. But that was about 15 years ago. And in the subsequent time, I went back over and over again to this thing, totally for my own benefit, my own being driven to try to come to terms with what happened. And only in the last few years did it occur to me that maybe it had evolved to a point where I could actually share it with somebody else and they might benefit from reading it. It was in a very different form then, it's really evolved.
I mean, it is kind of written because I'm so used to, reading quote unquote academic books. I mean, you are an academic, but this is a book about Haiti. This is a book about, this revolution. So reading a memoir like yours, which feels very stream of consciousness the way you're writing it, because it is kind of going back and forth to different periods where you're talking about your son as a young man, you're talking about yourself, your own childhood. I think that made it a little easier for me to digest, because as the book starts, it starts off, you get the phone call and, dealing with those emotions. Were editors trying to make you make it a little more linear, or did they give you a lot of leeway?
They gave me a lot of leeway. But then again, I wasn't really involved with editors until the very, very end. And the thing had evolved at that point into a pretty coherent shape, more or less what you looked at, Jason. So I was by myself with most of this. And mm-hmm. the reason, of course, is because I was writing it for myself. I was writing it really to stay sane and try to understand, what had happened. As some of you know, I've been noticing some of the sideline comments of people who are listening. In the wake of a suicide, the number one question, of course, is what happened? Why did they kill themselves? And what, if anything, did I have to do with it? Those are the typical questions that pretty much all loved ones who survive a suicide of somebody they're really close to ask. And I was really tormented by them. So it was for me that I started it, and 99% of it is kind of a note to myself. But then I did realize we're in the midst of a national epidemic of exactly what I suffered, namely a boy, my only boy, only child, who got so caught up in drugs, and before my wife and I knew it, was really entangled in addiction, ended up as a heroin addiction that drove him completely to despair, and then committed suicide. And the numbers, as you guys, I'm sure, are somewhat aware, are just horrifying, of tens of thousands of Americans dying every year from addiction, and many of them the same path to suicide that my son trod.
Yeah, we actually, Thursday, we had a show about the unhoused and some projects that are going on in Los Angeles. And my guest is a former addict, and actually was in the Hollywood and music business. So he has a lot of celebrity addict friends. And, you know, we kind of got into that conversation about opioid addiction and all the deaths that he's seeing. Which is something I definitely want to touch on, because that's a big part of this book. You know, recovery is something we discussed, like I said, the other day on the show. I would assume from your writing that you and your ex-wife spent your fair share on clinics and counseling. In the book you write, we had not parted on good terms less than 2 months earlier. A scene in his apartment had severely shaken me when I arrived at the apartment responding to Elaine's call to say that he was in a serious crisis. I found him not only drunk and high, but armed with two handguns, one holstered on each hip, and a dreadful-looking semi-automatic rifle lying on the couch behind him. It was 10:30 in the morning. He was watching Taxi Driver. "Oliver, what's going on?" I asked, not sure how quickly or how directly I should ask him about the guns. "What's happening?" I had known for some time that he owned several guns that had been horrified by them. Having long ago left behind my adolescent flirtations with guns, few things could have been more foreign and threatening to me. Early on, I tried to be optimistic. His interest in guns and the satisfaction he derived from them were remarkably intense. You go on to talk about how Oliver wanted to go to the mall and take a bunch of people out, and how he was dropped from a methadone clinic. How do you feel about the recovery industry in this country?
Just getting a call I didn't expect there.
Sorry.
In this respect, too, my experience was like so many people, beginning actually even before it got into the problem of guns, beginning with the OxyContin disaster, where the Sackler family basically swindled the United States into allowing them to the medical community to oversaturate the whole culture with effectively opioid-like substances that became incredibly habit-forming. And my son also got caught up in that. Actually, at the time that he died, now, as I say, about 17 years ago, Baltimore was pretty much the heroin capital of the country.
The Wire is down there, yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah. I mean, so he was in the middle of a kind of a pressure cooker for this whole issue, and was sucked up, as many kids. There were a number of kids in his little circle who also became addicts, and at least two of them I know of died of overdoses. Anyway, it was in that sense really a kind of typical piece of where we are as a culture. But it was also in this gun business. I think when he began to feel really getting caught in the addiction, mm-hmm. I think he really was desperate to gain control. And I think guns was a major way of making himself at least have a kind of a fantasy of being in control, of getting, of being empowered. Mm-hmm. That's my guess. I never really discussed this that explicitly with him. But I think that was a large part of what was going on. And then, of course, at the end, he uses the gun to get the ultimate little desperate, hopeless piece of control of killing himself.
Now, he was a father as well, and you talk about that in the book as well. What was that like? Because he was pretty young. I think he was 19.
He was just, actually, when Oliver died, he was just short of 23, but he was 19 when his son arrived. Mm-hmm. He and his common-law wife, they actually never officially married, mm-hmm. but they had had an abortion earlier and, of twins, as a matter of fact.
Whoa.
Which was incredibly painful to both of them. Mm-hmm. Not because they had really a hard line idea or value around abortion or not, but rather just emotionally for the connection to these people who they would never know. And so when she became pregnant again, they just, both of them refused the idea to abort it. And my grandson, who's now rounding up on 21, will be born. And he is, I have to say with great joy, he's a fantastic kid. I love him. I was trading texts with him this morning about visiting him up in Pennsylvania, where he's now entering his junior year in college.
That's pretty awesome. As I'm a young parent as well, not 19, but 21 isn't too far off when we had our first child, my now ex-wife and I. She's 25. Does it feel almost like a second life with the grandchild?
It does. The amount to which he reminds me of Oliver is prevents it from being completely a second try, because I feel like I'm having this deja vu whenever I'm with him. He looks and acts and talks and has a kind of a, you know, creative kind of offbeat spirit artistically and otherwise. It reminds me so much of his father that I sometimes have to pinch myself and remember that I haven't gone back in time. This is a new generation, but I'm certainly, whenever I'm with Jack, Oliver's son, I feel incredibly happy to imagine how happy Oliver would be.
Yeah.
That this really terrific kid is in the world. And I sometimes wonder, and I don't know the answer, how it will affect him. He, of course, for many years did not know the truth about his dad's death. He was 3 and a half when Oliver killed himself. And that was a huge issue for his mom, who I have great respect for. She is herself a school counselor. So she knows a bit about how to sort of deal with these kinds of challenges, but she didn't dare to tell him early on. And in fact, it waited until he was 12 that she finally said, you know, I've always told you that your dad died of a heart problem. In a certain sense, that was true. Oliver was really brokenhearted about his own life, his own helplessness, his own feeling of failure. But she said the truth was that he was so desperately miserable and so hopeless that he shot himself to death. And one of the fascinating things was Jack, who at that point was 12, said, I know, Mom. I know that's what happened.
Really?
Well,
how did he find out?
Amazingly, well, partly it's just because Jack is a really smart kid.
Yeah.
But the other thing that's kind of interesting, I'd heard of it happening before, but this was, you know, when it comes home to roost in my life, mm-hmm. he was actually in the next room in bed and semi-asleep.
Yes, you guys talk about that.
When Oliver shot the bullet that killed him. And apparently Oliver used a pillow. I talk about this very
to silence it.
To silence the report of the bullet. So he I think it was one of those situations where he knew he heard something, and he knew, of course, life totally changed after that. The next day, you know, finding out his dad was dead. But it didn't register fully consciously, and I think it sort of drifted back, you know, later on, and he kind of connected the dots. And then he was inwardly convinced that his father had killed himself. But this is an interesting part again about what a great kid this boy is. he effectively decided his mom can't tell him yet. She kind of can't handle it. So he, as a 10-year-old coming up on 12, you know, for a couple of years there, he basically knew what happened, but he was sparing her having to tell him. So when she said, you know, your dad killed himself, and when he then said, I know, Mom, he wasn't exaggerating.
Yeah, and reading that part of the book, I found that fascinating and almost magical in a sense, because you're writing about it that, you know, your son, A, tries to use a pillow, and there's only so much you're going to silence a gun going off. They're pretty loud and bright, if you've ever heard guns go off in real life. So the fact that the kid slept through it, A, is a testament to him being worn out, being out like a light. And then the commotion of, you know, mom, oh God, when you write about his mom finding him, that is, you know, beyond heartbreaking for anyone that's ever had to find a person that's shot themselves or died of an OD. That's a heavy thing to find. And it definitely wears on you for some time, because that becomes the image that you're stuck with.
Of course, I don't know how she's been able to manage it as well as she has, to tell you the truth. I think that she initially took the opposite course that I took. I dove into it, rethinking it, re-experiencing it, looking at pictures of Oliver, kind of like trying to figure out what everybody tries to figure out who's the loved one of someone who commits suicide. You kind of have to, you have this incredible urgency to know what was that about? Why did they do that? And how am I to interpret this? How am I to deal with it? And Anna, I think, took the opposite course. She said to herself, I need to worry about this little boy, 3.5-year-old little boy. I got to make sure he's okay. And I don't have the luxury, I think she felt, to think any more about what just happened. I have to kind of box it up and deal with it sometime down the road of my life, because I've just got to take care of Jack, which I totally understood. I mean, I respected her for being able to actually pull it off.
I was going to ask you about that, because your son passes away. He's out of your house and had been out of your house, it sounds like, for some time.
He had up to a point. He did come back 3 years before.
You could talk about that, yeah.
Yeah. I was on sabbatical in France at the time, and I had been there maybe 4 months and was going to be there another 1 or 2 months. And I got the news from my ex-wife. I'd been divorced maybe 4 years at that point. From her, but we were still very much in contact, especially about him. And she called to say that he'd made an attempt. It was one of those attempts, which is kind of theatrical.
The cry attempt.
Exactly.
I'm going across the street, not down it. For
precisely.
I won't get into what it means, but for those that know what it means, they know what it means.
Exactly. He tried to cut his wrists, but in a very kind of tentative way in the bathtub, right at the time he knew she'd be coming home from work. And so anyway, that was 3 years before his death. I came back from France, and actually then that year, the summer of 2003, I moved back into the house where the three of us had been, and my ex and he had been living. She went to my apartment, I went to the house, and I lived there for a year with him, which was actually good for him, I think. The end of that year, 2004, that summer, he started a little business and seemed like things were moving in the right direction. Sadly, it didn't take. He was on methadone treatment, which was really, he hated. I mean, he was destabilized in all kinds of really challenging ways, but You know, and again, you ask these questions, where did it all become fatal? What exactly was happening? And I wrote the book in part to try to answer those questions as though I, you know, thought I could somehow figure it out. Well, of course, what happens, and the prime theme of the book really, is what do you do when you can't figure it out? When there's no figuring it out, you can't know, you're never going to be able to know. How do you live with that?
That is interesting that you say that. I met a woman whose son passed away due to a drug overdose, and not sure if it's a suicide. And kind of the first part of your book, you talk about the fact that your son messed around with guns a lot, and you were kind of under the assumption in the back, it felt like it was in the back of your mind a little bit, that maybe, just maybe, this is an accident. Him being maybe intoxicated, fooling around with a gun, trying to clean it, and it went off. And then you find out, like, oh no, this was no accident. This actually happened. This was something he tried to do. And it definitely kind of sends you into another almost spiral. And
that's absolutely right, Jason. That was the real, for me, hearing Anna say, oh no, he used a pillow to muffle the noise. Mm-hmm. It hit me like a brick wall. You know, I suddenly, all those doubts and all those questions about, maybe it was a mistake. Maybe he was just kind of flirting around with the idea and didn't really intend it. And then bang, the gun goes off. I didn't know. And it was torture not to know. And suddenly, in one second, I realized, oh my God, he did. He knew exactly what he was doing. He intended it fully, and did his best not to wake up his son, mm-hmm. to make his exit without disturbing the little boy sleeping in the next room. So yeah, that was what really, that week. A lot of the book is, as you know, it's a mm-hmm. kind of a diary of the week that he died. At least one of the strands is a diary. The other strand is, of course, me on an analyst's couch trying to figure out who the hell I am after this disaster, who I was even before the disaster, actually, and what was the relation between me and him and all the rest of it. Anyway, it left in me this kind of torment about knowing what happened, but at least I did know, and it was actually gratifying to answer that question. It wasn't just an accident. He meant it. I still didn't know what the motive was, but it was a piece of the puzzle that I actually wanted.
That's interesting that you say that, because my children are all alive, but they're far away, and I definitely deal with my own stuff with that. But in reading this book, more so reading your journey and kind of trying to figure out who you are as, you know, not just a man, but as a father, mm-hmm. was actually kind of really fascinating and extremely helpful. Because there's certain things that sometimes we don't like to say out loud. And I think what this book is you literally saying out loud the parts about ourselves that we don't like to admit, maybe. Mm-hmm. When you talk about kind of being a hermit, I found that kind of interesting, as I live a bit of a hermit life here in Mexico. But I did want to ask you about something that I think we touched on this a little bit on our show on Thursday. But one of the things you talked about in the book is not being on the best terms with your son when it all happened. Like I said, this past Thursday, we had our guest Bill Cody talking about addiction, homelessness, and how when you're deep in the throes of your addiction, it's often the case that many addicts sever familial bonds, mostly due to betrayal, like constant lying and stealing just to get high. Your son even writes a very poignant poem that you find kind of about how he's so sick and tired of being sick and tired of getting high. working with, I actually worked with, I don't think I told you this at all. I actually worked with the unhoused for some time. So I had to deal with that, hearing that story. My mother actually suffered from her addiction problems as well. But in the end, a lot of families cut off the addict, hoping that that action will lead them to finally get help. You yourself talk about talking with Oliver's girlfriend, kind of about an ultimatum for him to finally clean up. She's ready to evict him out of the property unless he goes and tries to get help. And yeah. I'm also assuming that you and your ex-wife are probably still offering, you know, I don't know. Are you still offering, like, look, if you want to get help, we'll get you into counseling. We'll get you whatever you need. You just say the word, but we can't just give you money for money's sake anymore. But there's shows like Intervention that kind of show a tough love model almost. And I don't think people understand that shows like that are just entertainment. That's generally not how the real counseling world works. You don't tell someone you got to accept this gift or, you know, whatever they say on the show, or we're not going to be friends with you anymore, because they'll definitely send someone kind of spiraling even more. And if you have severed those familial bonds, you pissed off all your real friends, kind of all you're left with at this point is your drug community.
Yeah.
Which can, you know,
yeah,
can actually take you out of recovery and, you know, back down
yeah.
spiral, if not worse, because yeah. You're going to have memories before you got clean, and there were good times in your life. And sometimes you shared those good times with the people you were getting loaded with, and not every straight person, wants to hear those stories or empathize with those stories. So I just wanted to get your take on kind of that portrayal of that tough love kind of recovery. How do you feel about that? Also, someone that works.
That's a great question, and partly because it's just exquisitely both complicated and personally painful. It's absolutely, it's so difficult, as everybody sort of says, but nevertheless, when you're actually in it, it's just horrifyingly vivid and overwhelming. That you dealing with an addict is just incredibly taxing. It's an almost no-win situation.
Mm-hmm.
We actually, I put an incredible effort, as did my ex-wife. And of course, we'd been separated for quite a few years at this point. I guess we were separated 6 years before his death. And we still really worked together with this. So we had that going for us. And right up to the very end, I had salvaged most of my relationship with him. We still saw each other a lot. There was a real connection there. And then the very, very end, the last month and a half, a very weird thing happened where it picks up on the story you were talking about, Jason, about when I come in and he's watching Taxi Driver and he has the guns in front of him.
Yeah.
And he says this absolutely alarming and unbelievable thing. He says, "You know, Dad, life sucks." And I say, "Yeah, I know it does, Oliver. It's really tough sometimes." And he says, no, you don't understand. He says, "I feel like going down to the mall and taking out as many people as I can before the cops take me out."
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, I didn't know we were even in this neighborhood, let alone that he was really contemplating that kind of act. And it just scared the hell out of me. This was about 2 months before his death. In fact, I think I can basically say, I think it's probably true. He killed himself rather than becoming a shooter at another, you know, mass killing. Because he was so despairing that he just was capable of anything. He hated himself. He hated, you know, he was just desperate. And after that incident, I was terrified, and I felt like, oh my God, I've got to do my duty here, and this kid is really dangerous. I've got to go to the police. I got to go to a lawyer. I got to go to a shrink. I got to go, you know, find out what can be done to prevent a disaster. And when he then tried to get back in a drug control program, this was in, again, about 2 months at the end of his life, he said, I'd like to get back in. And they said back, no, your dad called here and talked about guns, and we don't want you anymore. Which was devastating to him, and it severed his relationship with me. He called, and maybe fortunately, I don't know, I wasn't there at my office. He left this blistering message. He was so angry. He basically said, you know, I never want to see you again.
Yeah. Sort of thing.
He felt so betrayed. And I basically think that rupture of our relationship, we had been so close. He was really close with his mother as well. But ours was a separate thing, and it was very, very, very valuable to both of us. And I go into a lot of stuff in the book about times that we had together that were really just incredibly bonding. And I think that when he felt that, you know, the relationship with me was wrecked, I think his fate was sealed, quite frankly. Here's one last thing that just about kills me. I had written him a letter on a Friday. And it was a letter to say, look, I know we've fallen out, but we got to patch this together. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to kill both of us. Mm-hmm. And I then went to New York. I had a conference in New York that weekend. And on the train back on Sunday night, I got back in, and I learned 5 minutes after I walked in the house that he'd shot himself to death. I had not posted the letter. It had been almost all ready to go on that Friday, and I didn't put it in the mail. Who knows, you know, if I had managed to finish it and he got it on Saturday, who knows what would have happened. But anyway.
Yeah, who we don't know. And I don't know. It's
yeah.
The toughest thing dealing with addicts is that roller coaster of emotion. When they're down, they definitely have to bring you all the way down with them, if not below. And as a child of an addict, you know, that's how I grew up with that kind of roller coaster, and kind of still have to deal with it in certain capacities, which is extremely taxing. But which is another reason why I thought this book is so important for all of us, because often on this show we talk about inequality a lot, and neoliberalism and deindustrialization. I mean, this is a leftist show called This Is Revolution, so not often do we take on topics like this, but I think this is important as well, because one of the things that we constantly do speak about on the show is the idea of alienation and how it affects all of us. And as you're listening to the story of Oliver, a young man that actually has a loving family with means that can put him into these rehab centers, think about all the people that don't have that. Like I said before,
yeah,
severed what little ties they do have to any sort of helpful community. So, you know, the power of community, you know, I think we underestimate it sometimes.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Because it can really, you know, help get us out of these, you know, these massive holes, these ruts that we dig ourselves into.
Absolutely right.
But I do want to ask you one last question. And again, thank you so much, Dr. Boothby, for taking your time to talk with me. In reading your story, I often found myself empathizing with you, as you would blame yourself for what happened. What was the process to get beyond that? Or do you never really get beyond that? You write, everything I ever expected about the experience of death is upside down. He's dead, but in death, memories of him assume shocking force. Their intensity is all the more arresting because I feel myself to be so utterly drained and empty. I often have the sense of being invisible to other people, as if they might cast a glance in my direction and miss me altogether. Yet in his absence, Oliver seems impossibly, unthinkably, more vividly present than ever before. Mm-hmm. I am the one who is dead. I am the one who has been reduced to something vacant, barren, annihilated. How could anyone who's suffered a really bad death have gotten this wrong? How and why did we ever come up with the idea that the departed become empty specters, ghosts? On the contrary, stolen from us by death, our loved ones become incomparably more vibrant to memory and imagination, in a weird way, even more intensely real than they were when they were alive. If they were haunted by them, it is for being oppressed, not by their absence, but by their excessive presence. It is we, the survivors, who are deprived of reality, depleted by the anemia of grief. It is we who become ghosts.
Yeah.
That was one of the things I highlighted, a bunch of passages from the book. I won't read them all, but that was one of the passages that really, really stuck with me. I think because I can relate to it in some capacity so much that it is the survivors that become ghosts. So again, what is the process? Was the process? Do you ever really get over it? Because I think when you are the left behind of something like this, people around you kind of give you almost like a job. You're 3 days or 3 months of bereavement, and and if it takes too long in their eyes, they go, something's wrong with him. He hasn't been right since his son passed away. You know, oh, you know, that's just, you know, Rick, he's a little old because of what happened to him. What is the reality? Let's talk about the realities of that situation.
Well, it's quite true that people back off, if only because they think, oh God, if I bring it back up again, I'm just reminding him, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, making peace with loss like this, I mean, the short answer is you'd never get over it. I mean, you don't get over it. There's some place in your heart that is just permanently wounded, and you don't get rid of that. And I still have moments 17 years later when they're fewer and far between, that's for sure. You know, it tends to be the week he died, I'd have moments like this every hour where you just break down and start crying. Mm-hmm. Now it's every 6 months, once every 6 months, you know, or once a year, I'll have a moment where it just comes over me involuntarily, and I just am wrecked for the next half hour or whatever, you know. But I would say, let me risk this, which is for me the biggest point of the book, and actually it's the most philosophical thing, maybe unfortunately, but it's the most real thing for me. It was the thing that was most liberating. I would say it's the thing that's the most dangerous in a way, but it was the most liberating, and I think it was the most true. I finally realized that my intense desire to know what happened, which was totally what led to writing this thing, I thought, I got to figure this out. I got to get control of a narrative that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I got to tell it to myself. And I finally, after years of working on it and also just years of suffering through the memories and just thinking about this and going over it and over it and over it, I finally realized I don't know what happened and I can't answer that. And in fact, I then began to realize not only do I not know what he had in his mind the moment before he pulled the trigger, I don't know what our relationship was or wasn't in the weeks that led up to that. I don't know whether I was a good father or a bad father, not in any kind of definitive, conclusive detail. I realized, actually, I loved this boy. I loved him more than anything. But I had to also admit, I don't know why he became an addict. I don't know lots of things about him. I don't know why I comment on this in the end. I don't know why he had such a fascination, let's say, with clouds. He loved clouds. Mm-hmm. He just would get kind of dreamy and almost sort of hypnotized by an interesting cloud formation. And he'd say, "Dad, look at that. Can you believe that?" Or he'd find little rocks. He had a thing about these little round rocks, and he had them all over the place. I even have some in my study. They're sitting where they belong to him. Mm-hmm. And I finally realized, you know, I know he had those fascinations, but I haven't any idea why. And I suddenly realized, actually, this is something that is really essential to love. That when we love someone, we embrace something we know about them, of course. We know them and we love them for certain traits, I guess. But we also relate to them without knowing the whole story of who they are. They cannot show us everything. We cannot know everything. In fact, I think I've become more and more convinced that not only do we not know everything about ourselves, we don't know everything about the others we love. And remembering that and kind of cherishing it even, you know, giving us special attention to that. No, you don't know. Ultimately, the question about are you guilty of failure? Well, you know what? The really honest answer to that is you can't know. Of course, that can be an excuse. Mm-hmm. But I think I've become convinced that it was hard for me to actually accept it because I wanted to blame myself. And then I thought, no, I don't think that's right. I think in a way, the more mind-blowing and in a certain sense, more painful conclusion is you don't know and you never will know. And accepting that was really something for me. And I take it to be the most maybe original thing about the book, and I think the most challenging, but for me it's the most valuable thing.
Challenging, yes, because I think we always want simple conclusions, right? We want to know the answer. How do we feel better forever, right? Happiness has to be a perpetual feeling.
It's okay to
be sad sometimes. I don't want to keep you. We've already talked longer probably than you thought because of my audio issues, so I apologize again for that.
It's been well worth it, Jason. I really enjoyed the discussion, actually.
Well, and hopefully I'll get to meet you, as I'll be going most likely next year on tour with a documentary that I made, so we're definitely coming to the East Coast with it.
Great. Well, if you come to Baltimore, yeah, definitely get in touch.
I'm definitely going to be in that Baltimore, D.C. Area. So
great.
Thank you very much. The book is called Blown Away, Redefining My Life After My Son's Suicide. That is Dr. Richard Boothby. I'm so sorry. I can't hear my sound effects from that. Wherever you're, and the book is, of course, out.
Yeah.
So wherever you're watching the show or listening to the show on audio replay, there will be links in the description so you guys can get it as well. Thank you so much, Dr. Boothby, and you have a very good rest of your day.
Thank you very much, Jason, and good wishes for everybody listening.
Thank you. Thank you guys for checking that out. Sorry, I won't be able to go as long as usual. I had planned to open up phone lines today, and I just can't do it with the setup that I have at the moment. Everything, I have no words for what happened. I won't even get into it because you guys probably don't care anyway. That being said, the show will be back Tuesday. We'll be talking with Matt McManus, who wrote a new book about right-wingers. Again, I was on Ben Burgess's show last Friday. We did a fun in-studio thing in San Diego, me, Ben, and Jordan Dubin, who actually made me a wonderful cake for my birthday. So shout out to Jordan Dubin for, and I didn't even know she was going to do that. Made a whole cake for my birthday. It was really awesome. But I was telling Ben, and as like him and Matt kind of almost, it feels like they punch themselves in the testicles when they read this right-wing nonsense that they read. Definitely check that show out. We did a review of the movie Creepshow, but most of it was me and Jordan teasing Ben Burgess, so that was a lot of fun. And if you give a damn, the last chapter of my Black Yacht Rock series is out, and the song is called Bill Cosby. is Black Excellence. In his longest song, clocking in at 11 and a half minutes, Sonic Roller Coaster, Matthew Film Guy agreed that it is, as he was one of the listeners to it. You can see some of the stuff. People sometimes ask me, what guitars were you using? That's some of the stuff I was using. You can't see all of it. But again, thank you to Dr. Richard Boothby. Thank you to the guys that watch the show and check this out. It's a heavy topic, but it's one of those things that I think affects us as well. Not everything has to be, you know, Democrats suck and you know, hammer and sickle, yay. I think, you know, dealing with the realities of the world that we live in and alienation and, you know, I'm sure that everybody listening, watching this show is probably separated by one or two people by someone that's, you know, suffering, you know, in the throes of an addiction. And this is a hell of a book to read if you're dealing with something like that. Or maybe someone's even dealing with loss. This is a great book to read for that as well. Like I said, there should be links in the description to the book. There should be links in the chat. Hopefully one of the fine moderators will put a link in the chat. I'll definitely leave a link in the comments if it's not in the description. And definitely put it in the description for the audio-only show. And we will be back Tuesday. Yeah, someone said Jimmy Buffett passed away. Yeah, I saw that. I woke up to that this morning, that Jimmy Buffett had passed away. But that being said, I'm going to take off and try to fix this problem so we're ready for you guys. I can be in my regular studio and you guys don't have to see the mess of the recording room. But if you're bored, if you want something to cheer you up, definitely check out the Black Yacht Rock EP. It is an ode to the black bourgeoisie. Black Yacht Rock, the title track, the second track. These Negroes are wearing Air Force Ones at the Vineyard. And of course, the closing track, Bill Cosby is Black Excellence. So definitely check that out. Let me know what you think. And we are out.